This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. These next 2 weeks on Cadenza, we'll break mold and speak with two men who bring you the music through their record labels, recordings, and distribution networks. Next week, one of the most influential and significant figures in this realm, Klaus Heyman of Naxos. But this week, we chat with a gentleman who founded and has led the small but important label Starkland for 25 years, Thomas Steenland. Starkland isn't fancy, doesn't have a huge advertising or promotional staff or budget, is completely devoted to contemporary music, and to that fact is not based in New York City or even more chic Brooklyn, but rather in Boulder, Colorado, and was formed back in 1991 to simply promote a single composer's works, that of the electronic acoustic media composer Todd Dockstader. You're listening to part six of his six-part work called Water Music. Over the quarter century of Starkland's existence, the label and my guest have held fast to its principles, with each CD release dedicated to a single composer. Many of them have gone on to be some of the best known and important American composers on the scene today, such names as John Adams, Laurie Anderson, David Lang, Meredith Monk, to name a few. Along the way, the Starkland label has won awards, been recognized for its efforts by major media and press across the classical music and non-classical music spectrum, even dabbling with crucial technology advances in sound over the years, all due to the vision and dedication of my guest. I spoke with Thomas Steenland a few weeks back by phone from his offices of Starkland Label, again in Boulder, Colorado. I'm talking with Tom Steenland, who, congratulations, 25 years with Starkland. You're kind of in rarefied air, because in 11 years on Cadenza, I haven't had many. Cadenza's, you know, showcase program where we interview musicians, you know, conductors, composers, performers, and it's very rare to get somebody on the other side of the label fence, but I have had them over the years, so you're in very rarefied air with people like Klaus Heyman from Naxos and people like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, in founding and running a label like Starkland, it can be seen as, I know you're probably really tired of hearing this, but it can be seen as a labor of love. Well, that would be even true if this was coming out of the east side of New York. However, you did now this for 25 years, and you've done it out of Boulder, Colorado. So what was the initial investment and passion in the music that made you want to start this label? Why in Boulder? What was the thought process 25 years ago?
Well, there are several reasons why I founded Starkland in 1991. I had been previously running Owl Recording and released a number of new music recordings there, but Owl had certain restrictions, and it was necessary to find funding, and that sort of limited the repertoire to essentially what was then known as uptown composers. Composers that had credentials, composers that could get funding from the NEA or from their university. And I was aware of there was a burgeoning downtown vital music scene that was totally being overlooked by Al. So that was one reason. But then another reason was that it was the era where CDs were taking over and LPs were going away. And specifically, Todd Dockstader's LPs had all sold out. It didn't make sense to redo them as LPs. So I thought getting them out on CDs would be a terrific idea. So kind of putting all that together, I decided to found my own label and start with CDs and have the first two releases be two Todd Dockstader CDs. So that's how I started.
I mean, obviously you were interested in this music, passionate in this music.
Yes.
Was there ever, as you went and got past the Dockstader CDs and started to release, was there ever thought that you'd have to, excuse the phrase, but sort of educate the public to appreciate for a purpose, or was that never in the mix? Was it just, we're going to release what we're going to release and this is what it is?
Well, I do tend to release what I think is vital and distinctive, but I think Starkland's releases are also known for having fairly informative booklets.
Yeah.
There are bios of the composers. There are notes from the composers. And usually I have sort of a celebrity write some type of introductions. I mean, I've had introductions from John Adams and David Lang and a bunch of other people. And that's in contrast. I see some other labels that come out and there's just some nice graphics. There's the music and there's nothing written about the music. So I think being informative and documenting what composers have to say at that time has been an important part of what I've done.
Beyond the first two, the Dockstader releases, how are you going to build this label, sustain this label? Because obviously there is some kind of filter as to what sort of fits the Starkland model and what doesn't as you went. So how are you thinking in those years that it's going to be able to sustain itself? I'm actually going to be able to build it.
Well, after the Dockstader releases, I was familiar with the contemporary new music world, but I knew other composers weren't that familiar with me. So I started out with the next release after the Dockstader release. This was called From A to Z,
right,
which featured shorter pieces by several different composers that indeed did run from Charles Lumbercani into Pamela Z. And they were all willing to take a chance with me because they were just short pieces.
Right.
And then the idea was I would follow up with full CDs from each of those people. And indeed, I did that for Paul Dresser and Philip Imstein and Charles Lumbercani and eventually Pamela Z. So that was how I got started doing more than Dockstader.
Yeah, that was my next question. I mean, because outside of the samplers, the sort of the hallmark of Starkland is that the discs are single composer portraits, if you will, expositions, if you will, of one composer. And that was a conscious decision on your part, that you would take an entire disc and focus only on the music of that composer.
Yes, I think there gives a unity to the CD to have a single composer featured, and it also shows different facets of a composer that if you just present one piece, you tend to think of the composer just as that one style, but you can show more variety if you have a bunch of different pieces. And I also think it makes it more interesting to write about, and also if you're interested in, say, Charles Lumbercani or Pamela Z, here's a nice spectrum of what they've done.
I'll give you an imitation to like Macau's sound.
From a Starkland release featuring the music of Philip Bimstein, here is the third and final movement of Garland Hershey's Cows, this titled Moo, M-O-O, Movement.
When you take their calves away from them is on the count of they get a tight bag, you know, and they try to find their calves so they can relieve that pain. And for now, they'll bawl for 3 days. They'll bawl for 3 days. Just keep a bawling until pain goes away, and that's the reason the cow bawls when you take the calf away from her. Thank you. lot of cows will, they'll bawl because they're used to you or something like that when you come around. And, or there's another cow over in another field that they bawl back and bawl back and forth, 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 back and forth. Just keep the bawling, bawling, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They'll bawl for 3 days. Ballin', 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 fourth time. Because when I change them field to field, why you turn them in with them and they'll bunt one another and chase one another around until they get acquainted. They act like you and I when we haven't seen somebody for a long time, you know.
So back to my sustaining part of the question. So as you do this, were the composers coming to Starkland as the releases got out there? Were you hunting them? Was it a little bit of both? There has to be a sustaining model. I mean, you can go back to some composers, and you have done repeat discs of works by some composers, but right. You also want to keep building the roster, as it were, and sort of, you know, fleshing out the label. So over the years, you know.
Well, it's a mixture of how I come to know composers. In some cases, they've approached me. In some cases, I've already known them. And I attend a lot of new music festivals. For instance, when there was a festival in Telluride, Colorado, that Charles Amerikanian put on, I met a composer named Philip Bimstein, who I had never heard of, and in general, the world had never heard of.
Right.
And he had this amazing piece about cows. And he had a neighbor called Garland Hershey, and Philip walked over one day and asked Garland, "Why do your cows moo?" And Garland told him the story, and Philip thought that was interesting and made a piece that sort of became a hit for him and for Starkland. But I first learned about that when I just happened to meet him at this music festival. And in other cases, it was Guy Husevic. I had heard of him for years, but was not that familiar with his music. And many years ago, he gave a concert in Boulder. And I attended, and it was terrific. And afterwards, I introduced myself, and we struck up a correspondence. and that led to a bunch of his music coming out. So that's in part how he got to know composers.
The music scene, and then drill down further to the new music scene, it is not a vast network. Everything is pretty much connected at some point if you drill down.
Yes.
I mean, the latest disc with Guy, now Guy's been doing this for years, but also I think what's important, it seems, to the Starkland label is what Guy represents, which is happily now coming back with a lot of the younger artists, and that's the performer, composer, composer, performer, right? That's also been pretty important to Starkland.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Guy is someone who gets out there in the real world and performs, and audiences respond. And that's part of the contrast I was talking about earlier between the old division of uptown versus downtown. Uptown might feature academic composers that other people were playing, but downtown people and composers featured composers who played their own music.
Yeah.
And there's something vital and engaging about that. So it wasn't quite a conscious decision, and yet that often seems to be the case for a number of the releases that I've done.
One of my recent Cadenza guests is a major artist on the Starkland label, the accordionist, composer, extraordinaire Guy Klusevic. From his recent release on Starkland called Teetering on the Verge of Normalcy, we'll hear two works by Guy. First, Moose Mouth Mirror, featuring Guy in accordion and Todd Reynolds on violin, and then Guy with Alan Byrne on piano in The Day the Snow Fell Upwards. Thank you. the music on Starkland can, for those that know the composers are following what's happening on Starkland, that's a given. But there's a lot of new music here, all new music for the most part. And for somebody dipping their toe into what Starkland releases, this can be an adventure. This can be somewhat of a journey for people, you know, for their ears. How do you want them to explore? Like, how do you want to keep them engaged? How do you want to build the audience for Starkland beyond just the new music inner circle?
Well, I think the starting point is that the music is something that truly engages people. It's not music that you should listen to because it has great complex background and that it's sort of good for you to listen to this because it's new. Yeah. It's just because it's terrific, distinctive music. And some of this is very accessible. For instance, Guy's music is that way, and Philip Bimsey's, as I mentioned. And then other music is more challenging. Kilmacan or some of Elliot Sharp's music is more challenging, and yet I think there are still distinctive things going on there that is interesting. Yeah. And one great exception, which I love, is the Martin Bresnik CD we put out a few years ago. Now, he is, in a sense, a classic composer from the academic environment heading the Yale Composition Department, but his music is very engaging and very direct, and he's sort of the exception that proves the rule that you can, even in writing contemporary music, have it be engaging and not so complex and so complicated in the way it's put together that it's sort of impenetrable for a lot of new listeners.
Two selections from two important composers found on the Starkland label. First, from a new release of music by Elliot Sharp, we'll hear the fourth movement of The Boreal for string quartet, where the composer redefines this medium with performers using such new ideas as rewound bows, spring bows, bows fitted with metal ball chains, and other techniques for a new sound world. The Jack Quartet perform, and then some music by Martin Bresnik. The final minutes from his Prayers Remain Forever, performed by the ensemble Two Cents, Ashley Bathgate cello and Lisa Moore piano.
Thank you.
There was a time, and I think this has probably changed seeing what you've released more recently, but there was a time when someone might say, oh, Starkland, oh, well, they do a lot of composers that are electroacoustic composers, and that might be a term to somebody looking for new vistas, new avenues in music that could be almost as off-putting as saying, well, they're serial 12-tone composers. It could have the same type of effect, you know? I'm just curious, there is a part of your catalog where composers did practice in that idiom. How would you frame that? It's not quite true today. I mean, how would you frame that term as it applies to the Starkland, what's in the Starkland catalog?
Well, electroacoustic music has been important to me. And I think Todd Dockstader is an excellent example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a lot of music, say, coming out of the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center at the time that some people have called, say, beep and boop music. And that was pretty dry and fairly hard to get into. Dockstader's music was created more intuitively, and it's very visceral and powerful, and people that I think have little or no interest in contemporary music in general and are more interested in alternative music, they really mm-hmm. responded to Dockstader's powerful music. So for me, the electroacoustic name is something that I actually like and differentiates from more uptown studio electronic music. For instance, Todd doesn't use any synthesizers. It's all from real world sounds, and I think that affects how the music comes across. And it's the same thing with Philip Imstein. You might call that electroacoustic because he records an interview with someone and then manipulates those recordings, but his music is delightfully accessible, and I don't think it's off-putting, and people like that music that maybe have little awareness of the new music and scene in general. So I don't see electroacoustic as an off-putting term, but maybe others do.
Yeah. Well, it could also work the other way, too. Do you find yourself, or over the years, have you found yourself being able to sort of siphon off some listeners, some buyers, some purchasers of your CDs from the what would be called the pop music fringe, if you want to call it that, you know, the alternative rock, that sort of scene, they sort of can gravitate over to Starkland releases, right?
Yes, I think that's happened with some of our releases. I know one of the movements from the Bimstein, Garland, Hershey, Cowes piece was used as the theme music for a radio show, and it would get played like every day at, for that show. And some of the other music, like Phil Klein's music, he is well known for his Unsilent Night Christmas spatial outdoor work, in which everyone carries around boomboxes and plays music. And in New York, they will have literally thousands of people doing this, and it's spread to communities all across the country that do this. And that's a very public, very engaging thing. And I think something like that might bring more people in to listen to the Phil Klein releases that I put out.
Speaking of a Klein release, I was going to go there next because it's been like almost 15 years now, somewhere around there. You did a couple bold experiments, which got a lot of press with surround sound. And
yes.
I'm just curious whether, excuse my phrasing of this, but did you think that the surround sound, sort of the tech person, even the geeky tech person, could you think you could fuse those two worlds of those that really love new music and what was happening with new composers and the whole tech side? Was that the kind of thinking there, or was it just your passion for the surround sound? Or?
Well, it was my passion for surround sound. I originally, back in around 1974, 1975, was involved with developing equipment for quad sound, which was the earliest incarnation of surround.
Yeah.
And I always was interested in surround because in the research I've done, or when you go to a concert and you're sitting in the middle of a concert hall and there's a violinist or whatever on the stage, something like 90% of what you're hearing is surround sound, only 10% is coming directly to you. So surround sound is really much more natural in terms of how we hear. And I also think it's just a terrific medium for composers because they can totally immerse you in a whole sound field. And that, to me, is exciting. So I think that was the reason that I became interested in surround. And a lot of the music of the composers I commissioned for the Immersion DVD were people whose music inherently has some type of spatial aspect to it. And the specific stimulus at the time, 2000, was when the DVD audio format came out. It was the first time in history that you could hear high-resolution surround sound in the home. So I was excited about that at the time, and that's why I commissioned 13 composers to create pieces for the Immersion DVD.
Again, works by two composers who feature prominently in the Starkland catalog, from Pamela Z, her piece titled Bada Gada, The Reason Will Be Obvious, and then from Phil Klein, his Unsilent Night.
But I gotta go.
Well, back on the 10th anniversary of Starkland, maybe even the 15th, I wouldn't have had to ask this question, but here on the 25th, I got to have you look ahead. So you are heavily invested in a recording label, artists getting it out there, getting the music out there. So what do you see as the future? And I know there's no crystal ball, but I mean, what's going to happen, in your opinion, the next 5-10 years with either recordings, hard discs? Where are we going as far as what you think?
Well, that's a really important question, and I wish I knew the answer.
Yeah, so a lot of people. Yeah.
Every time I get together with composers or musicians, I frequently ask them, what are you thinking we'll be doing 10 years from now? How will we be listening to music? And they all say, I have no idea.
Right.
And they all say, well, shouldn't you be the one that knows? And I don't know the exact answer. I mean, the standard answer today is streaming is going to take over. People aren't going to own music. We're just going to listen to streaming. I somehow just innately sense that there's value in having a high-quality recording of music along with some information about that music that is presented to the public in some way. I mean, you can just do a video of a concert and post it on YouTube, but to me, there are a lot of drawbacks to that, and it doesn't serve the music that well. Mm-hmm. And even listening today on Spotify and so forth, I think because of the quality and because of the attention factor, that's really not an ideal way to listen. So I think there's a value in having a documented high-quality recording, and somehow a label like Starkland fits into that. And the second part, I suppose, is that there's so much new music coming out, and there are a lot of people interested in new music, but the conduit between all that new music and the interested public is something that Starkland can do. I mean, we have a reputation. People expect a certain quality, a certain interest in our music. So there are people that know that if Starkland comes out with something, that it's probably something interesting. And this is a way to help filter the incredible amount of new music out there so that listeners can at least know that there's some editorial guidance behind our new releases. So I think that can be a role of labels too.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like you said, there is no crystal ball, and everybody is still scratching their head here 5-10 years after the whole inevitable seemed inevitable. You know, there's always been a place, and I think back even to the LP days, of labels that concentrate on music of our time, of living composers of our time. And you think LPs, like, well, of course, CRI, but, you know, even
right.
Desto and Poseidon and labels like that, which I don't think ever made it to the CD era. And Starkland's been one of those labels where it's important that it's there. It's important the work you do. And
Thanks. Yeah, I think so too. And I hope other people do also.
I do too. It's just we all have to ride the wave into the next years of how people will receive and listen and be able to get what you do. And that's, you know, we're going to have to wait and see how that all plays out, you know. Well, congratulations on 25 years.
Well, thank you.
In light of our last question, I hope you another 25 years, but I have no idea what that might entail.
Yeah, I think it's kind of unknown to all of us, but I mean, I have 4 or 5 CDs coming out this year and 4 or 5 coming out next year. So at the moment, very active. And
is that a good pace for you?
Yeah, that's a lot. It sort of increased. Several years ago, I wanted Starkland to be able to have a structure that would go on to the future. So I converted Starkland to a 501c3, a tax-exempt label. And there's a structure there for it to keep on going. And then I also opened up Starkland expertise in producing recordings to composers that can just approach me with their own projects,
right,
and maybe some funding, and then I can put out more that way. So there's been an increase in what I'm doing. I sort of joke to people, I'm finally figuring out the CD thing and how to do more just as the CD era is closing.
Well, thank God it wasn't a cassette. Yeah, that's true. Well, like I said, congratulations on the landmark. And like you said, well, it's important that labels like you exist for composers and for performers and for audiences. So thanks for taking some time.
Okay.
Founder and director of the Starkland label, based in Boulder, Colorado, Thomas Steenland. Starkland celebrates 25 years of promoting living composers and today's newest music. All the selections you heard on tonight's program are available on the Starkland label, as is much more. Check it all out at Starkland, StarkLand.com. I'll leave you with more music reeling back to how and why this enterprising label was begun by my guest Thomas Steenland 25 years ago. It was to record the music of the late electroacoustic American composer Todd Dockstetter, and I'll leave you with the movement titled Tango from his work Quartermass. As always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting and an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you.
Yeah.